I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, the word is out. They're gonna talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 670, The West Side Story.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's called.
Yes. Yeah. And I put the emphasis on a weird part for you.
Thank you.
Just to make it a little extra odd.
The wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yes. Precisely. Yeah. So I guess before we dig in, let's go around the table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Quick shameless plugs. Let's just knock it all out of the way. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. Wherever you find a podcast, you can find us. While you're there, be sure and follow us so you never miss an episode. If you'd be so kind, maybe rate and review us so the people that came along after you know that we're worth checking out. You can also, if you want to keep up with us throughout the week, find us on Facebook, facebook.com/RealSpoilers. While you're there, like the page and join the group. And the group is called the League of Show Shares because we're hoping you'll share an episode. People who were kind enough to share an episode last week include Librarian Cynthia, Eddie Lancaster, Tammy Sherman Powers, Ralph Dribble, Heather Sachs, Julianne Jordan, Gabriel Lugo, Chris Williams, Chris Wilson, Minorities Report, Colby Mack, Linda Wright, Invasion of the Remake, Mike and Oscar, M.N. Miller, Kathy Woods, In Session Film, Feelin' Film, Geek to Me Radio, Binge Movies, Ryan Terry from the Forza Crowd Podcast, Ronnie Castle, and Matt Naglia. So thank you very much for sharing an episode in your Facebook or Twitter feed. We greatly appreciate it. And finally, don't forget, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/RealSpoilers, where for $5 a month, you get all sorts of bonus content, and you become secretly our favorite listener. So
I've got two of the Scream movies covered.
Okay.
I'm working on two more. Hopefully,
awesome.
I'll get two more guests.
So there's all that. I guess let's just dig into West Side Story. I know Joe is chomping
at the bit
to talk about musicals.
Now, wait a minute. We've had somebody pass away a couple days ago that's like right in your wheelhouse.
Oh,
how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Like,
yeah?
I got to see him like literally like 30 days before he died. So Mike Nesmith from the Monkees died. And if you've listened to this show for any amount of time, you know the Monkees are my favorite band in the whole world. And so there's only one of them left.
Yeah.
So
was he sick? I guess he was sick.
Yeah. And like if you saw that and it was a farewell tour and they said that going in, but in retrospect.
Yeah.
Someone just saw him a month ago. They said he was out there still.
No, I saw him a month ago.
That was when they were here a month ago?
Yeah,
yeah.
They were here on November 9th. He died on December 10th.
Wow.
Yeah,
and,
so I mean, it's not like he had been away for a while. I mean, he was out there touring.
Yeah, and was at the venue that where I worked, because of course. and it made money. That's all that.
That's all that matters.
That's all that my bosses need to worry
about.
That's
right. That's right.
Yes, I booked my favorite band. Yes, it made money. But yeah, I know on that tour, when it first kind of fired back up, because they were one of the first bands to announce that they were going out after. I guess we can't really say after
not
COVID,
after anything
when we thought it was after COVID
before after the first variant.
Yeah. And in retrospect, now they're revealing now, I shouldn't say in retrospect, that he was the one driving that. He was like, no, we need to do a farewell tour and we need to do it now.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I want to go out right now. And those, you know, they're very camera friendly. So you can watch all the clips of those concerts online. And it was pretty rough.
Oh, really?
I'm not going to lie. Like, he definitely got better as it went on, but it certainly wasn't as good as he was pre-COVID,
sure,
with all due
sure.
respect. And
that's a shame that he had to be out there touring, you know, like he was still
well,
there.
Well, I
don't
think he had to be. That is the key phrase.
It sounds
he wanted to be.
That's what I mean. Yeah. I was just about to say, I mean, clearly he knew it was important to the fans.
Yeah.
And it very well could be a lot of people's last time to ever see him, whether the audience is aging, he's aging. Clearly,
right.
You know, I mean, that's just a sad thing that he couldn't, you know, that he had to go out. I mean, I guess he was doing what he loved, but still, it's just like he could have been resting or whatever, but he was out there for the fans and gave.
But like I said, I think he wanted to do it. He did not need the money.
Yeah. Sure,
like,
sure.
I mean, don't forget his mother invented liquid paper.
Sure.
So he had all that money.
For sure.
He had a huge lawsuit with PBS in the late 90s. And
oh, really?
I think he won like $40 million from
Dang.
PBS.
Yeah. Well, those poor, poor donors. Little did they know.
And
paid for the lawsuit from donors like. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, PBS tried to screw him over, and
really?
He called him on it, and he won big time.
Good.
So,
what was he doing with PBS?
So Mike Nesmith was always kind of a visionary. He was the first person to put a barcode on a record. How about that?
Oh, wow. Interesting.
He basically invented MTV. So he had a show for Nickelodeon called Pop Clips.
Oh.
And they were like, we're going to turn this into a network. We want you to run it. And he's like, I don't want to do that. He's like, just buy it off me. But
oh, and they're like, no, that's okay, and then just did it.
Yeah, I think he still got some kind of money out of it, but not near what MTV ended up being worth, I'm sure. But so, I mean, he was always kind of on the cutting edge. The first Grammy awarded for a video album went to Mike Nesmith. Hmm. So, I mean...
That is interesting.
Yeah. So, what was the question?
So, why did PBS...
Oh, why did PBS... So, he started a home video distribution company in, like, the early 80s, right? So, he would sell videotapes, and he acquired the rights to all of the PBS shows except for Children's Television Workshop. Mm-hmm. And so, PBS was happy with that deal until... Because he was like, oh, if you want to buy a VHS copy of that last episode of Nova, right?
Yeah,
sure.
Like, you know, I mean, who cares, right? Like, so he was selling them, but it wasn't huge. So then they put out a little something called The Civil War.
Uh-huh.
And he's selling these box sets because it's what, 9 hours long?
That's the Ken Burns.
The Ken
one,
Burns.
Right?
Yeah. It's the thing that made Ken Burns a household name. And, like, that show was massive.
Yeah.
And people wanted it, and so he had these real nice box sets of all the episodes, and they were going for like $300. Mm-hmm. And so the way I understand it, it's been a while since I read about it, but the way I understand it, the way the contract was written, PBS could control how many he made, right? Like,
okay.
They would put in the orders for how many he should produce. Mm. And in the past it was Nova, and it was like, right. Oh, make us 6,000 copies of that. That should be funny. So they started like, peppering him with orders, like way more, like making him make way more of them than he could sell, even though it was really popular.
Oh.
And so he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, we don't need these many. And they were like, make them. And they basically bankrupted his company.
Right. He couldn't pay them all.
Because then they wanted to get the rights back,
right.
So they could sell it and make all the money.
Oh, that's messed up.
And they finally saw the value of it. And so, and then they sued him for breach of contract. And then he countersued them because he was like, well, you...
They're driving me out of business.
Yeah, like you're ordering things nobody needs to drive me
to
out of business.
The
and
back.
So
that's
they were fighting over that for a while. And then he finally won. And
no wonder.
I think he won like $40 million.
Good for him.
Wow.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was always one of those guys when it came to stuff like that was just in the right place at the right time. Not that he wasn't thinking too, but like with the liquid paper, his his mom invents liquid paper, and his rights to that expired in like I think like 2000.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
which is like exactly when you want your rights to liquid paper, right? Like by 2000,
the advent of the computer.
Like who's using liquid paper anymore?
Right.
Now you just take your laptop and throw it out the window if you mess up.
Yeah. So
I guess I'm buying a new one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he was always well ahead of the curve.
That's always kind of cool to hear those guys that were just like two or three steps ahead.
Yeah, I remember talking to Peter Tork once, and he was saying, hey, I've never seen this in interviews. Somebody said to me, he goes, Nesmith I've never seen a guy like it. He's like, this guy could fall ass backwards into money like you've never seen. Like I'll call Mike Nesmith on a Monday, and he'll be like, "Welp, it's all gone. Like I got sued, and my company's out of business, and blah blah blah, and I'm gonna sleep on somebody's couch." And then you call him back on a Wednesday, and he's like, "No, somebody just bought this idea of mine for $12 million. So, no, I'm good.
So, wow.
But he always had a love hate relationship with the Monkees, and
because he wasn't he kind of dropped out for a bit, right?
The last U.S. tour he did with them was in 1969, he returned in like 2013, I think it was 2012, something like that.
Do we have a sound for like Monkeys Corner?
I know, right?
Yeah,
no, because Tom doesn't bring it up every episode.
It's like every other episode. But
and you brought it up this time. So.
But I will also say that I feel like when Davey died, I thought, well, the Monkees are done.
Sure,
like because Mike would never go back and do anything with them. So I consider this last 10 years of Monkees stuff. It's all bonus. It was amazing.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
I got to see the Monkees in different configurations like 7 times over the last 10 years. I got to see Mike Nesmith solo 3 times.
Did you ever get to see like the original lineup together?
No, because they only did... They
stopped in 60, whatever.
Peter left in like 69, and then it was the other three, and then I think in like 70 it was just Mickey and Davey, and then it was done. And then the reunions were always Mickey, Davey, Peter... Mm-hmm. Peter, Mike showed up to like 1 or 2 shows to play like 2 songs. It's always in L.A.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I was, you know,
he wasn't going out of the
he was just there
hometown.
Yeah. and then they did a tour in England in 97 where they played like 4 dates, and that was supposed to come to the States. And then I think if you map out the timing in the middle of all that, like in between the England date and what would have been the U.S. tour, he got his $40 million from PBS.
There it is.
And he was just like, I think I'm good.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So no, I never really was afforded the opportunity to do that. So
when did Davey pass away?
So Davey passed away in 2012, I think it was.
Okay, that was later than I thought.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's been almost 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, I guess technically it's been 2 years because he died on a leap year.
Oh.
He died on February 29th. But... they put out 2 records in that time period. One was just a Christmas record, which was fine, but they put out that Good Times record, which had songs written by Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie,
Rivers Cuomo
from Weezer, mm-hmm. Andy Partridge from XTC.
That's cool.
Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne produced it, who was also the music director for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And that album is like ridiculously good.
Yeah,
like,
that's cool.
Yeah, so I mean, for them to put out a career capper like that, like I said, it's all bonus and stuff I never thought we'd get. So I was
that's cool, man.
Like, I just look at it through that prism that it was never it wasn't supposed to happen.
Sure.
So
sure,
and
sure,
we
sure.
got the last 10 years because Nesmith came back into the fold. So
that's pretty cool.
Thank you.
Do you have a musical act that like
is like your thing?
Is like your thing.
No,
I
not
mean,
really.
Besides, like New Kids on the Block.
Yeah, I mean, I've got my Marky Mark poster in his Calvin Klein underwear.
I was like, was he in the band long enough for the
Marky
him
Mark
up?
Wasn't in the band.
Yes, he was.
He was in New Kids on the
Block.
Was,
he was in the, like one of the very early renditions of New Kids.
I think.
Yeah.
I thought it was the cousin that was in there.
But the brother.
Is it brother?
Donnie. Yeah.
Donnie was like the bad boy. Marky Mark was in there for like a couple of
coffee. Yeah, I thought Marky Mark did something.
Donnie's the bad boy?
I know.
And what's Donnie do? Because Marky Mark was like,
Marky Mark's pretty bad.
Hate crimes.
That was pretty bad.
He was beating up Asian people for no reason. And
Donnie, as far as we know, was tearing up hotel rooms. It's as far as they got with Donnie Wahlberg.
I was like, I'd rather somebody beat up a hotel room than some random Asian.
It'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so messed up what people, these celebrities do, and then they somehow get a pass and people forget, and then they're in hit movies. And
yeah. Speaking of,
yeah, West Side Story.
So here's what I will say. It kind of
felt like a ripoff of Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, a little bit. Right? Maybe a smidge.
Did anyone
yeah.
else notice that?
Yeah, just okay. a little bit. Steven Spielberg, his career is so interesting as a filmmaker, right? Like, early in his career, he's making, like, the perfect movies,
he invents
right?
the summer blockbuster.
He does, and he's yeah. making, you know...
Duel.
I mean, Duel's a good movie. Yeah. I think Duel, Empire of the Sun is also an interesting movie. But like Jaws and Indiana Jones. So like he's doing all of these, but he's also had his hands in all of like the movies that are the groundwork of my love of film, right? Like
yeah.
everything. And
I mean,
then
for our time period growing up, obviously a lot of those films, Tom, you know, were a big part of his life too. But E.T. when we were kids,
E.T. Poltergeist,
E.T. came out when I was 12. So yeah, totally. I mean, I 13, I guess. But I saw Raiders in the theater.
God,
right.
You know,
that's a perfect movie. You can't.
Me and Joe discovered that later. But like, see how like you saw Raiders, and then you saw E.T., and then we saw Jurassic Park, and then we went. You know,
see that's the dividing line for us, because Jurassic Park, while I did see that in theaters, like isn't one of the ones that I go to. Like
really?
it's the 70s and 80s stuff that is like my draw. I think
that's
Jurassic Park.
You would have been like 10 when it came out, right?
I've been like 11.
When were you born?
82.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But still, I'm like, that's like perfect age for big screen dinosaur
movie. I'm watching
movie.
Superheroes, right? Like superheroes and wrestling and all that.
But
you know,
most
like,
people our age would
totally.
Be like, Jurassic Park, that is a touchstone.
Yeah.
Film.
Easily. And you it know? Still holds up, right? Like,
so,
it's still an
like,
amazing
like Spielberg's
looking movie.
Been around doing this for generations.
And then he kind of goes in a different direction, right? He starts kind of to make the I feel like everything up until a certain point is like the For You movies. And then everything after that is the For Me movies, right? Schindler's List. I don't know, like any
he
of that,
does
like
pretty
adult,
good. He yeah, does them hand in hand.
He
really
like,
does.
What's he's Minority Report.
Golly, I always forget that.
War
him.
Of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds. Like yeah. he's still
pumping
doing...
out blockbusters, and then doing Lincoln, and doing and like
Amistad,
The Color Purple.
Right.
He's been doing those
type of movies
hand in hand. So he really has never stopped, because he realizes that's how I get my money
right.
to make whatever I want to do. Like we mentioned last week, Schindler's
Ready Player One.
Ready Player One.
Yeah, yeah, I mean,
which did seem like it had been a while. Like Ready Player One was like, whoa, Spielberg's doing some big crazy, because he had been some doing Lincoln and all that stuff. But he really has been doing that for a while. We mentioned last week that Schindler's List and Jurassic Park
same year.
So it's like he had figured out that that's how, you know, one for them, one for me, and really perfected that.
And I think also like he kind of ran into a situation where the big tentpole movies had kind of left him behind.
That's
right?
True.
Like his version of a big summer blockbuster isn't what a big summer blockbuster is as much anymore. Like, you know, it's superhero movies now, right? He doesn't do superhero movies. And
give him Superman. How do you top that?
But so I mean, I think, you know, he also kind of drifted away from that. Plus he's in his 70s. So he's
sure.
Like, he's doing what interests him.
What he wants now.
Yeah.
And so what I was trying to get at is like, this is an amazing looking movie. Like this is
absolutely
one of the most beautiful looking, well shot, like perfectly shot movies I've seen all year.
Which you got to give it up to his DP too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, obviously Spielberg has the vision.
But sets and everything involved. Where I have to believe some of that CG. Like building around the sets and things like that. But still you've got like, I think that is a big thing that is missing in film right now is like that tactile feeling.
Physicality,
right? Yeah. Like JJ did it. And we talked about that. And when he did The Force Awakens is like,
speaking of JJ, boy, there are a lot of lens flares in this movie.
Wow. He was like, hey, if he can do it, I can do it.
But I think, with a movie like this, you get the Spielberg's vision, which
you get the feel like a Spielberg movie.
Yeah, and so he's never done a musical before, but he brings that expertise to it.
But he's done a lot of musical numbers. He's got a lot more musicals in his repertoire than you might think. There's like a musical number in 1941. The opening scene of Temple of Doom is a musical
number.
That's
a massive musical number. Yeah, you're totally right.
And there's a couple others mixed in. I think there's a kind of a musical sequence in Color Purple. Okay. Like, so while he's never done a musical, he has done musical pieces.
Mm-hmm, well, that's, sure. I mean, you got to think, though, like, I have to believe that this is the one, right? Like, this is the passion project he's wanted to make for however long, right? Because he's a kid of those movies.
Yeah, when the original West Side came out, he would have been like 13 years old,
right in the wheelhouse.
Cannot,
right? Won 10 Oscars.
Yeah, and it was nominated for 11 and won 10.
Right,
it was like crazy. It was the number one record in America for like 56 consecutive weeks.
Yeah,
Rita Moreno, first Latin female Oscar winner.
Is that right?
I believe.
I think so. Yeah,
but it was groundbreaking.
The touchstone.
It's a big 10 Oscars is a classic. But so with this film, he brings expertise, but you got to give a shout out to the production crew, because this production is amazing looking. So you mentioned the cinematography, Yanis Kaminsky,
is that Spielberg's guy?
War Horse, Schindler's List, okay. Minority Report, you know, he's done other things too, but yeah, he's a Spielberg guy. This is a beautiful movie. Like each shot
is
a piece of
that.
Art. Yep. Like it really
you
is.
Can pause this movie at any point randomly, and it looks amazing.
Yeah, it really, I mean,
hot take, I think this might be better than the first one.
I've never seen the first one, so I have no point of reference.
The first one's really...
And the first one's really good.
Really
but
good.
That, I mean, that's all, like, sets too, right? Like, it's not filmed on location. Is that all?
No, it wasn't CG in the original.
There's some of it where they're on city streets.
Oh, okay.
And But I think that, like, he fixes a lot of the stuff that hasn't aged well in the first one.
Does he? Because holy crap, there's a lot of language in this movie that I was not expecting.
Yeah,
which is fine. I get it.
Yeah,
it's for the time.
I mean,
it makes sense.
If you would have totally sanitized it, it would have taken away.
Plus, also, what's the point of sanitizing? The point is that they're racist.
Yeah, that's
right. Like, it's like you can't make a movie about racists, but then make the
racist
not
say
racist.
The whole point is that they're both. These are both poor. You know, criminal, underprivileged gangs, but then look how the police operate so much better with the whites as opposed to the
It's always
they don't like the white gang, but they like them more than they like the Puerto
Rican clearly,
gang.
And it's the same thing in the original. That's what it was built to be. So you can't take that away.
No, I completely agree.
It's the message of the movie.
It's funny, as I'm watching it, right, we're talking about the movies of the 70s and 80s, and I think of, like, the language in those movies. And I started to show Bella, who is now 10, the Bad News Bears, and they get to a certain scene and they're dropping some language. Leanne walks in the room and she's like, nope. And I was like, how do you like this movie? Is the one of the best movies, best baseball movie. I get it. Okay.
Yeah.
This is not a hill I'm going to die on.
As long as she's old enough to where you can tell her that this was, you know, she's got to be able to comprehend.
Like, I think she's right there on the cusp, you know?
It's like they said this back then. It wasn't right then. It isn't right now, but
it's still one of the best baseball movies ever made.
And part of the scene, I know exactly the scene you're talking about. And, you know, part of, I mean, the joke of it is that it's just like, it was jarring to hear, even back then.
It was wrong.
It was just like, what,
you
this
see,
kid's
the, you
crazy.
You see the look on that, on
Buttermaker's
face. We're just like, all right.
Yeah. And it is also the evolution of these characters of, like, that's where that kid starts
right.
and here's where he ends up. But they also, it was a lot easier to have a character behave like that, but still portray them as lovable
as a kid.
Then.
Sure.
Well, especially as kids. But back then, like, it was like, it was, it was not advised, but it wasn't like the, I don't know, career-ending life.
People would go on Twitter
right. He wouldn't have gotten canceled for that. But when the language starts in this one, I was like, dang. Like, even in 2021, I was like, oh, that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
I think we're all on the same page that, like, you cannot sanitize that, right? It's part of who those characters are.
Yeah, and I think one of the things this movie does that kind of fixes from the first one is the first one, they behave in a lot of the same ways, but the white gang, right? But they're presented...
The T-Birds is what I thought they were called.
Yeah, the T-Birds. Exactly, yeah.
The Jets are the white gang and the Sharks are the Puerto Ricans.
But that they're still presented as kind of these, like, lovable rapscallions.
They are not
who
that
just
kind
of get in over their heads. And
I never get that feeling in this.
Yeah, and this one, they're criminals.
Yeah, like this one, it's like you understand their background and what they're up against, but they're still, like... They're not good.
No, I think the only one that even has, like, semi-redeeming qualities is who's the other guy who's not...
Riff.
Like, he has
scenes... I liked him a lot.
He's really... Like that guy's
great.
Really good.
Yeah.
That guy's really good. But, like, he has scenes with the main character, Anson Elgort.
Yeah.
Where, like, he doesn't seem as bad.
So Riff is Mike-faced?
That guy's gonna... I think they just
pulled him out of, like, community theater or something.
I don't know,
like,
but that kid...
He was in... I haven't seen it, but he was in a show, I think, that I'm trying
to... A TV show?
Yeah, it's an Amazon show, Panic?
Nope.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it, but apparently he's really, really good. And he's the second build in Panic. So
that kid's gonna blow up.
But apparently people are like, yeah, if you've seen that show, he's amazing.
That is the one thing I did notice about this is Anson Elgort is the only face that I recognize, and I think
Reed Moreno
had no idea who that
maybe
was.
Not Joe, but
okay,
nope. I mean,
she's in the original.
I will tell you,
she was an audible. She was on Oz. Like she's been in a lot of things.
Oh yeah, true.
She was the nun in Oz.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was gonna say.
Okay.
You know her.
Well, when she shows up on screen, there was an audible gasp in the theater of like, I made the joke earlier is that I dropped the average age of my theater down to about 90 when I saw
so
it.
So they know.
Oh, they absolutely
knew. It's great. So Rita Moreno plays the widow of the candy store owner that was in the original. So like in the original, they talk about going to Doc's store.
Oh,
and so
I
now
see.
She, in present time, she runs the store and she's Doc's widow.
Okay.
So it's kind of cool
way
they
to get
did
her
that.
In there, yeah.
And she's in, she played Anita in the original.
Okay.
So,
okay.
But
I will say like, if he had cast a bunch of Disney kids or what, you know, the musical kids, I think this would have been a million times worse. But because I have no frame of reference for A, this movie and B, any of the actors in this movie, I was able to watch.
You know,
their
Brian Darcy James.
Who's that?
Officer Kropke.
Oh, sure. But and Corey Stoll.
You know,
as well.
Yeah, Corey Stoll
is.
Stop
putting that guy in a wig, by the way. We all know he's bald.
Yeah, I was like, it was funny when he shows up and I'm like, that hair looks pretty real. Like, that's not right, but it looks pretty.
We know that guy's bald.
But Corey Stoll plays Lieutenant Schrank and Brian Darcy James is Officer Kropke. So they put the two that you'd probably know as the cops.
Like, characters that you almost never see.
Yeah.
But. So, like, I think that if they had bigger names, I would have been even more
distracted,
taken out of it
totally.
Distracted. So,
yeah.
But because they didn't do that, I was into the performances.
So, I have to say, Ansel Elgort, so, you know, he got in some trouble. There were accusations. He was accused
allegedly.
Of some Me Too stuff. Yeah. And then other people came out and started saying, oh, yeah, this behavior sounds familiar. And then he went away for a while. This movie got a lot of backlash because he had already been cast.
Was
it done? They were filming it. And so then and it may have been close to done or done, but, you know, and they didn't recast him or reshoot or whatever. And then the pandemic happened. So a year went by and then this came out pretty quietly as in I didn't hear a lot of it come back up. I mean, it was mentioned, but I mean, it came out. Here it is. I think Ansel Elgort is a black hole of charisma. Like I could take or leave that kid. I think he's very just.
Every scene he was in, I was like, eh.
Watch the original with Tony, and he's smiling and charismatic. Ansel Elgort, to me, just feels like Baby Driver, he doesn't talk, and that's perfect for his role. But no, I mean, seriously, like, he plays that stoic, quiet introvert.
Yeah.
And I like Baby Driver a lot, you know? And it's a great movie, and he's good in it. He plays that character perfectly. God, trying to give him in this charismatic role, I don't know. It didn't work for
me. You have to believe that when Edgar Wright filmed Baby Driver, he was like, man. Look at all these great actors. And then, like, a couple years after, he's like, God dang it.
I know.
No, we're never going to talk.
That movie's cursed. Yep, it's a great
never
movie.
Never going to talk about that movie again.
What did you guys think of Ansel Elgort? He just didn't.
He was fine for me. Like, I warmed up to him as the movie went on.
Yeah.
Because initially I was just like, whatever. Because Riff was who I.
Riff,
oh my gosh,
I don't think Riff should have been Tony. Like, sometimes you see movies and you're like, oh, they got the leads wrong. Yeah. I don't think Riff could have pulled off Tony. But
no, Riff, I mean, he was perfect.
And he
Riff,
nailed
but.
That kind of like, I'm in a 50s gang.
Yeah.
Or I guess early 60s. But like without being over the top or cartoonish.
Yeah.
I felt like
he was great.
Yeah.
But Ansel Elgort, he just to me, he's so ho-hum, plain, non-charismatic. I just think he
was boring in Divergent.
Yeah.
If I remember right, he was the one we were just like, oh, Lord.
He just doesn't
sucks.
Emote like he is such a nothing. You know what I mean? That's what I mean. I don't see the charisma. And again,
hasn't there been a couple actors like of that generation where we're all just like, I don't get it. Like, why do they keep casting? Who was the guy? Who was Harry Osborn in Amazing Spider-Man.
Dane DeHaan.
That's another one. I'm just like, stop it with that guy.
But yeah, I don't know. So it didn't, I mean, it was okay. I'm not saying he was bad, but I don't see like what they saw in him to cast him, and I didn't think he was great in it.
Do you think Spielberg was looking for his next muse? And what I mean by that is like, obviously DiCaprio was his guy for a while, and then Shia LaBeouf was his guy for a little bit. So like he, and you know, like was he looking for like that next guy?
I mean,
guy
so
that
this
could...
guy was in Divergent. He was in The Fault in Our Stars, right?
That's that was the big one.
That, okay. Yeah.
I think that's the one that after Divergent really blew him up.
No, and I think
that was
Fault in Our
Stars
was first.
Fault in Our Stars was really good.
Okay.
And then Divergent was after that.
Well, either way, they were all in the same kind of, you know, he became a star and then did Baby Driver and then, you know, stuff happened and then pandemic and here we are. So I just don't see it. And again, if you go back and watch the original, Tony is so charismatic and smiles and whatever. And I get the charisma and the attraction. And here I'm just like, nah. Man, this guy sees this boring, you know, wet noodle. He just seems like so plain. I don't see
why.
Oh, because
he's Italian. He's a noodle. Nice.
We call it pasta.
So anyway, I thought he did an okay job with it, and for like skills I didn't know he had for singing and dancing, he was okay, but I didn't really believe it. Now, Rachel Ziegler, the other hand,
that's the guy, that's Maria.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yep.
She is so charismatic. She can sing. My God, can this girl sing?
Yeah.
She is so good. I loved her. She is going to be huge.
The dick Rita Moreno got in.
Yeah.
Where she's like, they finally got a girl that can sing.
They didn't have to. He's like, she's like, they didn't have to dub this one's voice.
Yeah. Which
like,
is
that's,
true, but yeah.
It's fair.
Yeah,
I mean, when they cast a white girl to play Maria and then dubbed the voice, like, it's like, why is she here?
What are we
like,
doing?
I know it's Natalie Wood and she's a big deal, but like, but yeah, like if she can't sing.
Oh, was Natalie Wood in the original one?
Natalie Wood was the original Maria.
And it's weird because she's white. When you watch it now, you are just like, that's so weird.
Because they made Rita Moreno wear
darker
brown face to darken up because to make her look, you know, quote unquote, more Puerto Rican.
Okay.
Because like that's the era we're coming from.
Crazy.
Like, yeah.
I mean, their skin in the original is very dark. All
who
the Puerto Ricans.
Who played Tony in the first one?
Richard Boehmer.
Okay.
So, yeah. I just think that, you know, the casting for Tony in this one's weird. But yeah, no. Maria, Rachel Ziegler just knocks it out of the park.
She's
going to be
really
huge.
Good.
She's so good. That scene where she is doing like the like operatic singing opposite Anita, like when they're both going and she's, I mean, it's amazing.
I can only, like, you know, we've talked about moonlighting and like the way those scripts were put out there. And you know, speaking scripts are one thing. I can't even imagine how difficult it is to have to sing something like that where you're both singing in different words, different song. Like, I cannot even imagine having to do that on screen. And I mean, unless they didn't and they've figured out a way to cut it together to make it look like it did.
No,
I mean,
that's how they do it on stage.
Yeah,
so
I feel like they had to do it together.
I'm assuming they're lip syncing on...
Oh.
Like, they're the singers, but, like, they pre-recorded the vocal track.
But it looks and sounds really good in this movie.
It does.
Some like movies you can tell.
You can almost hear an audible pop when they click to the studio version of them singing.
And some movies, like, they get the perfect shot, but their mouth doesn't move quite, or they stop singing and they just leave it in there because they're like, well, that's the best shot.
Right.
You know? Like, in this movie, it looks like they're singing the whole time. They do a great job. Yeah. But so bring me to my next point. Ariana DeBose as Anita, she was incredible.
Yep. There's not a weak person in this
but
cast.
She is. This is going to be a breakout role for her. I mean, Rachel Ziegler, certainly, but I think people have kind of known about her a little bit. But Ariana DeBose, I've never seen her before. She is going to be huge. She has that star power that we talk about.
Do you think she'll be huge on screen, or do you think that she'll make the jump to like Broadway?
I think on screen.
Okay.
I think on screen. When you do a movie this big,
I guess that's true, and you're working for probably one of them.
But the problem that they'll have is that they're when I mean the other people in this movie is that there aren't a lot of movies like this getting made.
I think this might be the last one.
So like you don't get a lot of movies that are going to utilize all of their talents that you're seeing in this film in the same way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. La La Land in 2017. I mean, musicals have been making a comeback and Greatest Showman was huge.
Do you think that Into the Heights is going to cause a stumbling block for studios to take a chance again?
It was during the pandemic.
What I mean by that is like this. To me, this has a different pedigree.
This got off to a slow start.
This
like,
one did?
I know the Thursday previews did like $100,000.
The box office is not good on this movie. Yeah. Friday night, like $4 million. It's not good. No.
So that's interesting, right? So
Heights is a big, smaller budget than a Spielberg West Side Story musical. Right, so right. This one would be the one, but I still don't think it's going to
be. So where do you think that comes from, right? Because we talked about The Greatest Showman, where that was off to an insanely slow start, and then it took off, right? And it made all kinds of money.
That one didn't have Spielberg pedigree, so that's the difference.
No. What I'm saying is, like, what do you think the difference is? But, like, this one's not going to take off, right? This is going to stay
around the holidays. It could take off a little, but what I mean is that Greatest Showman had the room for improvement, because if this one starts at, you know, 4 million Friday, if it starts off like that and it's Spielberg,
right?
You know, I think, but I also think there's things at play. There's new variants of COVID coming out. Here we are 2 years later, new stuff's being discovered.
I think this movie has an
older audience.
It has disproportionately older fan base. So
they're
like,
not going to the theater.
And they're slower to go to films, even in the best of times. So like, I could see this gaining traction and doing just continuing to churn $20 million for a while, potentially.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think going into the new year, you're going to see this one stick around.
I think it's going to get a lot of awards chatter, which is going to drive up interest.
You don't think the older crowd can't wait for the Matrix sequel?
Well, they can watch it on HBO.
I guess that's true.
I also think that, like, this is probably going to get a bunch of Oscar nods, and it will probably pick up a lot of Oscar nods, because the older Oscar voters are going to be like, oh, West Side.
Yeah.
You know,
Spielberg.
Somebody did say it, and the credits started, they're like, that was a masterpiece. And I was like,
It's really good.
The songs I checked out.
Yeah.
Right?
and like, I'm sorry, like, those are some of them. Best and most famous songs in the history of musical theater.
I
saw it with Crystal, and she had never seen West Side. Like, she didn't know till the end. She's like, oh, that was Romeo and Juliet. Like, it, you know, because she's like, I didn't know it was
she didn't know anything about it.
She's like, I didn't know it was going to be so depressing. And I was like, well, it's Romeo and Juliet. And she's like, oh, yeah. And
so she picked up on it, too.
But even then, she's like, but I knew all of the songs.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say I knew 75% of those songs for sure.
Oh my gosh. So I Want to Be in America. That was awesome. Yeah. Those costumes, they go out into the street and they're dancing and all in sync with their dresses moving and everything. That was a beautiful
dance number. I cannot imagine
how
hard that must be.
Oh my gosh.
To get everything in sync like that.
I was reading that their shoes were melting because they were doing it in the summer and it was so hot. And that they had to keep replacing their shoes because the bottoms of their shoes were melting.
But that sequence was amazing. And the numbers are really good in this, but I mean, that I Want to Be in America. And he moved things around, which is interesting.
He changed the order.
Because the I Want to Be in America is early on when they're getting ready to go out,
I believe.
Because all the girls are getting...
And I feel pretty got bumped up in a little bit in the running order. Because in the original version, it happens... I think it happens
before they go to
Does it happen like after Tony kills Bernard?
Well, it happens in this one, it happens after that.
Yeah, but she doesn't know yet.
She doesn't before.
Like, it opens up Act Two.
Yeah.
So does it mess with the flow at all?
It's a little weird for the momentum because Act Two ends with the gang fight, because it's your typical Shakespearean rise and fall action of like everything builds and then there's the moment and then everything after that happens in relation to that peak moment.
Yeah. Sure.
And so, it's
an interesting, I was trying to figure it out because I liked the whole thing overall and I didn't think it felt super jarring, but it was weird that Bernardo just died and they go to the I Feel Pretty and it's such a big happy number and I'm like, it was a little weird. It didn't ruin it, but it's also kind of like it's interesting because she doesn't know, right? And so we're seeing this thing where she thinks everything's all good and she's in love and her brother just died, but yet look, she's over here totally.
And not only did her brother die, but the guy that she's in love with and singing about is the one who killed him.
Exactly. Right. So purposefully, even though it's a jarring shift, and as the audience, we know she doesn't, I do think there's something interesting there.
Yeah.
Just to show how out of the know she is at that moment.
Right.
And it builds up the bomb that's about to be dropped because she's so happy.
Yeah. And they move the setting of that song. Like,
oh yeah, she was not working in a department store. When, yeah, in the original,
I did think it was interesting how she was pretty quick to forgive him after.
But that's how the original is too.
I get it.
Yeah, real but world.
Like, in real world, I was just like,
you get it.
He killed like your brother,
and we know it was an accident.
I guess that's true.
And we know all the things that he did to try to stop that fight from occurring. And I do think that, and this is just a flaw of the source material, is I do think that maybe we need a little bit more of her,
yeah,
hearing that story,
sure,
in a believable manner that
to,
like
to quickly forgive
he
him.
He was
and
doing
to...
everything he could to pump the brakes on that, and,
right?
And he did not purposefully.
It feels like he kind of did.
No,
because
he spins. I mean, he purposefully beat the crap out of him,
but then he runs at him.
I think it was out of like.
But he kind of spins around holding the knife and like, and they connect. Like at least the way I remember it, and this is kind of the problem with eyewitness testimony.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Like I remember it as him kind of spinning around and them kind of like almost walking into each other.
I don't
remember him like stabbing.
But
him.
his best friend and like
he just
adopted
got
brother just got killed, so I think it happened without him thinking.
That is probably true.
You know, and so, but I agree, and that's the thing that it's always been with the story, though, whether it's the original West Side Story or with Romeo and Juliet, where it's like, this happens, it always happens, and Juliet or Maria always forgive, and it's really quick. So I think you have to go based on the audience knows Tony,
right,
and how he was trying to stop everything, and Riff wouldn't let him, and all this. So that's just how this story goes.
Sure.
And so I know if you're watching for the first time, and I thought the same thing knowing it, and I'm like, man, that is quick, and it's your brother, and here's this guy you just met, but you're in love, so it's okay. Like, that's just the story. So I totally get that, you know, critique.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that was a huge tension moment too. Like in the song, like I'm with it. Like the whole fight where Tony is trying to stop and Rift is just like on another level of like, I'm gonna kill him.
You're
like,
not stopping.
You're
this
not
train.
Stopping. Yeah. And he's as hard as he's trying to stop
and
that train.
These dance sequences when they fight are vastly improved over the original too. That they still have their
goofiness.
Ballet moments. But like,
but that was the art of it, though. That's what
I think that like I really liked how that there are still those ballet type moments, but there's also like moments where it's straight up fight choreography
for a modern audience.
Right.
They do a good job of updating it while also retaining
ever have to fight someone and they start dancing. I'm not going to know what to do.
See? That's how you mess them up.
It's like that Norm MacDonald sketch on SNL. Oh, it's one of my favorites.
That's a great one.
So I was going to say, you really have to give a shout out to Jerome Robbins, who is the famous choreographer. He co-directed the original.
Okay.
And Robert Weiss is the other co-director. And when they made this movie, now when you see musicals, you're just like, yeah, well, they're kind of doing the West Side Story thing. We know what musicals are because West Side Story was so famous. But when you see this movie and they just they broke the rules. They said, oh, you can have a dance, but it's going to be or a fight. It's going to be ballet.
Right.
And this is how they fight. And they're representing it through ballet.
It's no different than when you go see Lion King, the theatrical production of Lion King, and it's puppets. And you see the puppeteers holding the sticks, and they're like, grow up, ignore the puppeteer.
Just enjoy what you're watching.
And after a minute or two, you do.
But it's
the same thing.
But that's so cool. I mean, that's the art form of it. Like but they invented that, right? Like they conceived it, and now every musical has built upon that and other musicals that have come. But back then, they just, people like, In a movie musical before, like if they were gonna fight it, but never
like Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah,
I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah, like you didn't really have an idea of like, well, how can we have them fight but not have them just like throwing punches and then doing the song stuff separately? They broke the rules and were like, no, we can just have people bust into ballet.
Right.
And if they're going to fight, they're just going to do ballet against each other and hold each other up and throw each other. Like, they said that's how it's going to be.
That became the language of Broadway fighting.
Did Bad do this? Am I right?
Who?
In Michael Jackson's Bad?
Oh.
Is that whole scene? Isn't
oh,
that
it's
all?
Very West Side.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, so like it's Beat It.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Maybe that's what I'm thinking
of. No, both.
Oh, okay.
They're both like that.
Which is the one that Prince was like, absolutely not.
I think that was bad because it's Wesley Snipes instead.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Like the movements, I was super impressed with how everybody kept together and like it was perfectly in sync. There's no moment where you can like slow it down and be like, look at that goofball in the back.
So that's
can't
why
figure it out.
That's why I think it's important to talk about the creatives and not just the cast and not just say Spielberg, because Spielberg isn't choreographing this thing.
Right.
No. Spielberg isn't doing this.
He's picking the choreographer though.
Yeah, right. I mean
the choreographer.
Of course.
Yes.
And all credit to Spielberg. But what I mean is that everyone's Steven Spielberg's West Side
Story. In a lot
of
ways a film director's a project manager.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
You know,
yeah.
But that opening scene, like you know you're in a different movie in that very opening scene when they're going to paint that mural mm-hmm. and they've got the paint and they're doing their dancing in the street and
snaps
and then the one kid comes across, I guess one of the Puerto Ricans, and he takes the can of paint and just pounds him in the head.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, we're doing that. Like, yeah. There's going to be violence in this movie. And I know the other one still has people dying, but it's a more arm's length kind of a violence, where this is like the violence is a lot more visceral.
I have a quick question about the non-binary character in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a character in the the original one? Are they played the same?
But there's a girl that wants to be a part of a gang and they're like, get out of here.
There's a like
people, so it's a girl in the original one.
Okay, it's first off the play came out in 1957,
right?
So keep in mind the vocabulary that they had for expressing that
back then.
Now, the character's name is anybody's, right?
I mean, yeah.
So, that kind of sends a message.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And then you ask, and then people are going to be like, oh, that original character wasn't trans. And then I'm going to say, I'm waiting on my computer.
But even if they weren't, it's a perfect update for today's world.
Oh, totally. Well,
right?
I'm just saying, that's my point.
Arguing. I'm saying like to Tom, like even if the original wasn't, and I know Tom's going to drop some knowledge, but if they weren't, who cares? She was a girl that wanted to be a part of the
guys. You telling me that character's not trans?
But if they weren't, who cares? Like,
but I know, but I'm just saying for the people that are suddenly theatrical purists,
yeah.
You know, and it's like, first off, I don't know how you can love musical theater but have a problem with the LGBTQ community.
Sorry, you are.
Like, I don't know what world you're living in, but enjoy your Gilbert and Sullivan, I guess. But
most don't. Most people that are fans of the theater and frequent the theater are LGBTQ friendly because that's the community that makes up
but
a
like
lot of
that
it.
Original character, when you go back and look at it with a modern eye and what we now know about the trans community, like that character's totally trans. And she's in the original Broadway production, there's a cut song where this character, anybody's, literally sings a song where she has a line like, why can't I be male? Why can't I be big and tough and strong and male? So, I mean, like, they were trying to have that be a part of the story back then.
Sure.
And they weren't allowed.
Without the language for it.
Yeah, and they didn't. Yeah, and
she wanted to be one of the guys, but
right.
But people then didn't read it as literally be a guy.
Right.
She's going to hang out with these
They
dudes.
Were like, oh, a tomboy. And
right,
it's like,
exactly,
well,
right.
A lot of those some of those tomboys grew out of it. Some of those tomboys chose to grow out of it because they knew their lives would be easier, and some of those tomboys just didn't have the verbiage to describe how they really felt and what they really were. But
and Jerome Robbins had relationships with male and female.
Oh, did he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't known nothing about, you know.
So I mean, you know, there's a lot of people involved in this that, you know.
But yeah, I know some people are trying to paint this as like this is some major revision.
Well, that was my question.
It's,
is
and
like,
it's
is,
not
is
at
that
all.
Was that character in the original, and then was it played the same?
And you even
get the same line at the end when she goes and finds that Chino's got the gun and comes back and tells them at Doc's.
Yeah,
and he says, good job, buddy boy.
Yeah.
That's not fan service to the trans community. That line is in the original production.
But it means that they finally saw her as one of the guys.
Right.
I mean, that's a...
But now it works on a different level.
That's what I mean, right? So it's a perfect evolution. If you have a problem for that, and we're in 2021, I could not think of a better...
If it wasn't
directly meant to be that or seen as that, what better thing could you have in modern eyes, which stays so true to the character? It's the
same. I think he even says in this, he's like, don't call me a girl. Don't call me a female. Don't call me that. Like, there's a whole like 2-minute scene where
yeah.
they are having that discussion. But I just thought it was interesting that yeah. like that character was even in.
Yeah, yeah. It's I mean that's the character really. It's so close, if not, you know, being interpreted the same way. So
yeah,
that's not
I,
even.
I think it's a perfect adjustment for that character.
100%. What yeah. else would you do in modern?
Well, yeah. that's the point, right? Yeah. 2021. That makes total sense.
Yeah, it's,
right.
And it's not.
They
like,
didn't just come in and say, "Oh, Maria's trans now."
Yeah, yeah, right.
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 Like, they, like, well, now you're telling a very different story.
Sure.
Like,
oh, you have a character that wanted to be one of the guys and dressed like one of the guys and looked like one of the guys.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
that's the character. So,
right, right, right.
No, it's that's crazy. And I think they did a really good job with the representation stuff here. I think this movie feels less offensive. It's offensive now because of the time period, you know, just the things they say and do, but that's realistic for the time period.
And it's
but,
supposed to be offensive, right? Like
the, yeah,
in the original, there's some things that are offensive that weren't necessarily seen through that prism
exactly.
back then.
Exactly. And now it reads yeah. more as in we know we're doing this and it's on purpose and you're supposed to be like, that's
right.
not cool. And these characters are supposed to grow.
These characters are supposed to be problematic.
Yeah.
Not lovable.
Is the rape scene in the original movie?
God, it's been so long.
I mean, I kind of feel like it's similar, but this one maybe
that
is
was
a little...
intense, too. I was like, man, you guys, you are, none of you are good people. You're
yeah.
all terrible people.
But I think that's what, you, I mean.
And I liked how the girl pivoted, like the white girl pivoted. Was
yeah.
like,
oh, yeah,
was
yeah,
like,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, get out of here.
And was trying to. To do her part to stop it.
Yeah, that's the thing though with these characters is again when you go back to the beginning and remember this is a gang of not
scumbags.
Good people. It
yeah.
is, and you're not supposed to like. Tom said it. They were like lovable in the original. Where in this one you're like, yeah, they're a Greek gang of criminals,
right.
and you're not supposed to think that.
We always have a tendency to romanticize the like.
The
villains of the past,
sure,
some, like yeah. like right, like I mean pirates, right? Like,
oh yeah,
pirates.
They
are
were
awful.
Doing some awful stuff.
They were the worst. And then
like, and
Johnny
and
Depp comes out and plays an
like,
adorable
oh,
pirate.
Just,
you're like, oh, they're so
yeah.
Fun.
And it's like, but you know, I mean, I think I said this in one of the episodes we did on pirates. I'm like, do you think in 500 years there's going to be like the 26-21 version of Johnny Depp is going to be playing some like
Hitler?
Blood or Crip?
Oh, maybe.
You know what I mean? And it'll be just like this wacky, lovable guy that all your kids want to get their picture taken with, you know?
That is interesting to think
it
about.
It is, but
it's no
mean,
different.
But look at Jojo Rabbit. Jojo Rabbit has like a fun, enjoyable version of Hitler.
But then they turn around and ram that
they
up your
do.
Ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. But
and they're also, he's doing that to make fun of him.
He is.
Right.
But at the same time, it's still this, to that point, though, he's still a character that you're just
but
like,
that's
well,
not,
he's
the,
not so
that's
bad.
Not the same thing, though. Johnny Depp, they didn't make him lovable so that they could make fun
so
of
they could
pirates.
Teach you a larger lesson
correct.
About how
they,
bad
they're
pirates
two,
were.
Yeah.
yeah.
That one was done specifically as like a F you to white supremacist.
Yeah.
Taika Waititi is Jewish, so like
it's
he
even better.
Is making fun of him, and then yeah, and they're doing it as yeah,
man,
and then show
movie.
You how terrible he is.
That's
so anyway, but yeah, so this follows the Romeo and Juliet story. So I think the things that stand out, you know, that opening number is really good, and they fight between the gangs. We're introduced to them. I think that you know, take or leave the stuff in the shop with Ansel singing, you know, tonight and all that, whatever. But the riff stuff really stuff with riff stands out. Stuff with Maria
yeah,
and Anita,
yeah, I agree,
really stands out. There was another.
How does he not get rained on in that bed? That's my
Which
question.
One?
Ensign Elgort, Tony, when he's sleeping down in the basement and like his bed is under the grate, under the street. And I was like, doesn't he just get rained on? Or people's like, you know.
Doesn't run into the
but
building.
It's going to come down. It's going to come down through the grate. If you go back and watch this, his bed, the head of his bed is in like this corner. And the light from the grate from outside on the sidewalk shines onto the bed.
Oh, that's weird.
Which means that like people are walking over his head while he's asleep. And it's New York, right? So it's just like dog crap.
Pizza rat is running
yeah,
around.
Just falling on his face while he's asleep.
Yeah, they should have had pizza rat jump and bounce off his stomach and just scurry away.
I will say the other thing that I noticed in this, and now I can't unsee it because of Tom, is shiny cars.
Yeah.
Like all of the cars in this movie look brand new and shiny. And I was like, oh, damn it, Tom.
But I'll tell you what, this movie, I'm glad you mentioned that. This movie looks and feels like an old movie.
Yes.
He captured,
I agree with
not
that 100%.
Only the look and feel of film, but the time period, the color palette.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I say on a technical level what this movie did.
It's so good.
Is impressive because you're watching this movie and it didn't feel like a new movie with an old gloss of paint on it. You know what I mean? Like it didn't look like something that just was a fake. It felt.
It felt to me there was, this felt like Psycho in a way. Yeah. Like Psycho has a certain feel to that when Marion Crane is in the city, just has a certain feel to it. And I felt that same feeling here.
The atmosphere. He was able to capture the time period and not just make it be a new shiny movie with a different color to it, right? Like it just, it had that feel, which I think was,
that has to do with like the tactile sets.
I love some of the new arrangements on it too. The Officer Krupke song, which is
that's another really good scene. They don't do anything as intricate as that in the original.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite songs from the play. But I
love the song.
But it's also like. It by with modern comedic sensibilities is a little cheesy, right? Yeah. It's a little cartoony.
Sure.
And they kind of slow walk you into that. Like they start with almost no music when they just start explaining to the kid. And I like how instead of it being on the street and them being goofy, it's like they're locked in this police station. Like the new locations for these songs,
yes.
I think
really
like, you know, I feel pretty set in the department store.
It really enhanced it because there's a lot to play with.
There's always been some complaints about the song I Feel Pretty because, like, the wordplay of the song, it was very Cole Porter-esque. And while it's a fun and clever song, like, okay, but, like, English ain't her first language.
Sure.
Like, and so, like, is she really going to be using these sorts of intricate phraseologies and wordplay when it's not her first language?
She just got there a week ago, right?
And up till then,
is that right in the story? She's only been there a week.
I didn't realize she was new to the country.
She just moved there. I mean, she's been working on her English, and is it in this one or they practice it and they put more emphasis maybe in the original one?
They go back and forth. Yeah. Between Spanish and English.
Oh, another thing, no subtitles.
Yeah.
They just let you live in
kind of
a
annoying
world where you don't understand the language, and guess what? That's how they feel in America.
Right.
So he flips it on you, which is really smart, I think.
I did like where the girlfriend would like constantly be on
English. English.
And I know is a plot device for the audience, but I did like the fact that like sometimes when you watch these movies, it's like, why are these characters when it's three Spanish speaking people in their apartment? Why are they speaking to each other in English? They're only doing that for us.
Right.
And so like I liked the transition back and forth.
It was smart though that he did that to make you feel like you couldn't understand. Really smart choice.
But also with I Feel Pretty, it like the original version, like it can come off as kind of like a little flighty and a little conceited.
Oh.
Where in this backdrop of the store, it's like she's around all these things she can't afford and she's playing dress up and it gives it a less like arrogant vibe of like I'm pretty, like it's like, oh, I'm pretty because here's this scarf that costs a week's wages,
I'm surrounded by all this pretty stuff,
all these things that I'm probably never going to be able to have.
I got you.
Because of the world that we're in.
That makes more sense.
So
where is it set in the original one?
In the bed, getting ready in her
bedroom. Yeah, she's like getting ready to go out, okay. I think. Yeah.
So the Officer Krupke one is a really great number. They're locked in the police station. They get word that they're questioning them about
the rumble.
And so they bring them all in and then they got to go. So they lock them in there. The trans person, they ran out,
right?
And Krupke's trying to go chase them down.
Yeah, the antibodies makes a break for it.
That's
and
right.
So they all run after
him. He locks them in there. And I like how the prostitute or whoever that is locks herself. She's like, I'm getting away. Locks herself in the cage.
That is a super subtle way of her saying, I am not going to be stuck in this room with these animals.
Totally, exactly.
Yeah, I am going to lock myself in this jail cell. Bring the key in with me,
I didn't really get in the moment.
Yeah,
you know?
So I like how they did that to where she's like, "I'm getting over here and waiting until you know."
Yeah,
whatever.
Like the and it kind of lays the groundwork for like these guys aren't cute.
No,
they
would have messed with her
for sure.
So they do this number though, and I really like it. Is that they eat like the characters play all these other characters like Krupke, the judge, and all this, and they go back and forth, and it's really playful, and it's a great number. It's way better than the original. You make a good use of it. And the other number, the fight sequence when Riff gets the gun,
Cool
and
Boy,
Tony,
which is my I think it's just called Cool. Yeah. That's my least favorite song in the whole show. Like, I think that song is so like just dumb,
and they made it awesome,
and they made
movie.
It work here, and the whole fight over the holes
was good. What I'm saying, like, this is so different, and I thought that song and that number was awesome. Riff gets a gun, Tony's like, yeah, no, give that to me, and he takes it away, and the whole time they're back and forth trying to get it, and Tony's dancing around, and Riff's, you know, lunging for it, and yeah, he's almost stepping on these holes they could fall through, and really intricate choreography and avoiding things, and it was awesome.
You know what was interesting about that is that in that scene, there's a power shift in that scene where the entire, I would say about 3/4 of that, Tony is leading that entire thing. And then there's a flip where Riff takes the lead and is beating Tony at every second, every step, every way. Like, he's one step ahead of Tony. And I thought that was kind of interesting given where we were going and like the idea that Tony and Riff had started this gang together, and Tony gets shipped up. I will say, he's a little young, right? Like, he's like, I've been gone for a year. I was like, then you're not in school anymore, man.
Yeah.
Like, that's not the way this works. You don't get to go to the dance after you've been in jail for a year. But there is like there's a power shift in that moment where I think before.
Well, Riff's the leader. But
he wasn't, though, right? Like, Tony was
like
the leader.
Tony was the leader, and now that Tony's been gone,
correct,
Riff stepped in.
Well, I think even, like, when Tony comes back, the T-Birds, like, show up, and they're like, okay, like, we're with, you know, everybody kind of falls in line.
But Tony can't be around it.
Right.
Like, Tony knows he can't be around it because it's going to violate his parole, so.
But he goes to the dance anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, in this moment, it feels like Riff makes the move to take the power from Tony.
Well, finally the people are following him. You see the other guys are there, and they're like, yeah, we've got Riff's back.
Nobody really goes to bat for Tony anymore.
Well, because Tony's going against what they're trying to do, and so I think they realize that the old Tony is no more.
Right.
New Tony doesn't want anything to do with them, and they have nothing else. This is their life, and so
their neighborhood is collapsing around them.
Yeah, yeah. Not to mention,
because that's new too, right?
Yeah, they said, like, what was going up in the
Lincoln Center.
Lincoln Center.
So long. Like, it's
that
like,
was really clever the way they did that.
Yeah,
that was not happening before.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, it's like they're in a war zone and they're fighting over something that none of them are going to have in 18 months,
which,
like,
I think didn't.
It just heightens the futility.
Corey Stahl say that? He's like, what are you fighting for?
Right.
Like, this you're going to be out of here in 18 months anyway.
Yeah.
And it just heightens the futility of it. And that's always kind of the point of Romeo and Juliet, right? It's just how futile it all was. Like, none of it mattered. Like, this was all dumb. And it it just heightens that.
Yeah.
Like, it's,
Yeah. So, I was impressed with it from a technical standpoint. I think the story is fine.
It's
a good story.
It's Shakespeare.
It's totally
this is one of the best stories
it's
ever
Romeo
written.
And
like,
Juliet.
If there's any flaw in the story, it's just that it's been repurposed so many times that there's no newness to it.
Yeah.
So like that can make it feel maybe not.
I guess that's what I meant.
But
right?
Functionally, like, the story works amazingly. Just the way. You know, it's like I said, the classic rising fall action that you would learn about in college or in high school English. But it's like everything feeds up to this point, and then when that thing happens, then everything after that happens as a direct result. I mean, that it's literally like it does all the things that we complain about other movies not doing, where you're just like, well, this only happened because it was a coincidence and you needed to move the story forward. Like, there's none of that to the story, right?
You're absolutely right.
There's
none
of that. And like, and when Anita gives him the bad information that Maria is dead, like, it makes perfect sense, right? Like, it's not,
I did like that where she's like, do you think, is that how that goes in the original too?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you think she was going there to tell him that she was
going
to do it, or initially?
I think she was going there, like, and that's what makes it a tragedy, right? Like,
right.
It comes so close to working out. Like, she was going there to be like, Tony's going to come down here, because if she was, if she would have just never done it.
I guess that's
she
true,
was
yeah.
clearly going there, and then
they
assaulted.
And then they were awful to her, and so the only power she had in that moment was that one piece of information.
Right.
And so she's not only going to not give them that information, she's going to flip it and be like, she's dead.
She doesn't want Maria to be a part of anything to do with these horrible people that tried to rape her.
And not only is she dead, but Tony indirectly caused it. If Tony hadn't killed Bernardo, then Chino wouldn't have killed Maria, even though he didn't. Like, it's, you know, like you kicked over that domino that caused the woman you love to die.
And then because she said that, then now Tony doesn't care about his life anymore. And it's just all so close. And that's the tragedy Romeo and Juliet.
And that's when I'm like, no, it's a great story.
I'm going to drink the sleeping potion and they'll think I was dead so that we can get away. Oh, he finds me and thinks I'm really dead. I'm going to kill myself.
The real
now
potion.
I'm awake and oh my God, he's dead. So I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah.
But this one, and maybe like the original, but Maria doesn't.
Yeah, they leave Maria alive.
Does she die
in the original one?
Yeah, and Romeo and Juliet.
I know that.
Oh, okay. But no, well, when we say original one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean the original West Side Story.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that she makes it out alive.
I think so. But that's the difference between Romeo and Juliet is it's like, well, they both. It's tragic no matter what. But, you know, she takes her life and then these two kids are dead. These two families fighting when really they shouldn't be fighting each other. There's worse things at play.
Right, sure.
You know, they're fighting the wrong enemy. The common enemy is these people taking
systemic issues.
I think this is a perfectly crafted movie. I don't think this is going to win something.
Yeah.
What that is, I don't know, but it's going to win
something.
Like,
it's not your thing, but you can recognize
that. Absolutely appreciate
they knocked it out of the park.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But on a technical level, the craft
it is off
behind
the charts.
This movie.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Without question.
So far one of my favorite movies of the year.
Okay, right on.
Costumes designed by Paul Tazewell. Gorgeous costumes, period appropriate, and the dresses and everything looked amazing. And I was trying to find the choreographer. Maybe
Did
it was
they have
Spielberg.
An Oscar for that?
Not an Oscar for it, but I can't find it listed. Which
Is Spielberg.
And you're right. Yeah, probably was just Spielberg doing
it. Sure, you just did all the dancing.
Hold on, I want to mention it because it was really good. West Side Story.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Tom. This is not my jam, but I can absolutely appreciate why this is somebody's jam and like the skill and effort to make this thing work. Like, if you could keep me engaged for 2.5 hours in a musical, well done.
Yeah,
you know,
it was just a master class in filmmaking on every level.
This is the Spielberg I kind of have missed, I guess. Like, just, I don't know. I think that he has done, Ready Player One did not have the same feel as this.
Yeah, I would agree. There was too much in Ready Player One.
Yeah.
Like, it was sensory overload.
I would like for him to go get back to like 1970s and 80s Spielberg.
Yeah.
Tony Award winner Justin Peck did the choreography. So he's a Tony Award winner.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The choreography is amazing in this. Also, we have to mention, because we hadn't yet, sadly, Stephen Sondheim just died.
Yeah.
And he's the one that did the music and lyrics for this show.
But what a coup for the PR team to get him to die right before the movie came out. Just really.
What you didn't know is that Anne Rice also had a movie coming out, and she unfortunately just passed away as well.
Oh, did she?
Oh, yeah. Last night.
Oh, I have not seen that yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Sondheim. He just played a large role, the character, in Tick, Tick, Boom.
Yeah.
The amazing
Andrew Garfield
movie directed by Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's about Jonathan Larson, the creator of Rent. And
my favorite musical.
Is that right?
No, I hate it.
Oh. I love it, so we cancel out. But Tick, Tick, Boom is an amazing film, and Andrew Garfield gives a career best performance in
that
movie.
Guy.
He is so good, but I mean, this is him disappearing into this role, singing, dancing, the charisma we talk about. It's amazing. He's going to be nominated for an Oscar. I would not be surprised if he won.
For Far From Home.
But Lin-Manuel Miranda directed that. It's his directorial debut.
Oh, cool.
And the movie's amazing. It's on Netflix and it's really good. So I would say, but Stephen Sondheim was around when Jonathan Larson was trying to break onto the scene. And so,
A musical too?
Tick, Tick, Boom's a musical. Yeah.
You get me for one.
Adapted from his. We should go back and revisit that because it's going to be.
We're going to do Music Man.
But who played, did you watch that one yet, Tom?
I have not.
Okay. Who plays Stephen Sondheim? Is it Brad
Pitt?
No, I think it's the guy from Billy Madison.
Bradley Whitford?
Bradley Whitford,
Okay. I think
I think you're right. I think I've read that,
Bradley Whitford, who has really come a long way from like, I'm not going to be typecast in these stupid, you know, roles.
He was almost Chandler.
Oh, really?
It came down between him and Matthew Perry. And
that would have worked.
Normally, awesome. when you see like the guy, that, you know, like the guy that almost got the role.
That's so, he has the same cadence.
You're just like, ah, that wouldn't have worked. And when I hear Bradley Whitford as Chandler, I'm like, totally.
Yeah.
I almost might have liked it better.
He has the same cadence.
He does.
Yeah.
He's great, though, and he has a wide range of abilities. And anyway, he plays Sondheim and is really good in Tick, Tick, Boom. So it's like, that just came out. West Side Story remake just came out, and sadly, Sondheim just passed
that's
away.
That's tough.
Well, anyway, I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the table, and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at Joey Butts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
This is Tom. Follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online at facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, don't forget our Patreon. So that's it for this one. Next week, we make up to Joe and we do a Spider-Man movie.
I paid my dues.
So there you go.
I think we should just circle back to Tick, Tick, Boom.
Hey, you know what? I'll do it on my own. I don't even care.
He's like, it'll be behind the Patreon wall.
That's right.
So anyway, that's it for this one.
Any bets? Are the other two going to be in it or not?
This is my bet right now.
I think so.
I think you are going to get Venom. I think you're going to get both Toby and Garfield. And I think...
The cat or the actor?
The actor.
I just want to... Maybe Garfield will be in it.
I think we're getting symbiote Spider-Man. Okay. That's my call.
We shall see. Yes. So, anyway, that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, Nathan tells Sarah that Sky lost the Cuba bet. Get ready for a spoiler. Say it twice, 'cause we already warned ya. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot. Real spoilers. Real spoilers. Real spoilers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.